We had a chat with Stephen a couple of days ago about whether he'd be willing to do the introduction, and he said, yes, and I'll say something very positive about you. And I was a little bit worried about when I heard that, because it's kind of like, you know, when you've got a good joke to tell, and you kind of say, this is a really funny joke, you're going to love this joke, and then it kind of falls flat. I'd prefer to come in with basically no introduction, because now you've set the bar so high, all I can do is just disappoint everyone who's come along this evening. But thank you for your kind words, and it's great to see so many people here this evening. Kind of when you put these things on, you're a little bit nervous that it might be you lecturing to your family. But I do have my family here, which is great to see. But we've also got a whole lot of people from different walks of life. I saw some past students come in as well. I've got some current students here. Great to see. Extra marks for your assignments this week. So that's good. And we've got people from my church family as well. So thank you for making the time to come down. Friends, colleagues, just thank you for coming along this evening to be a part of what I've got to share. When we kind of got the book coming out, I was doing a bit of thinking about how I'd like to launch it. And the standard thing is you kind of come along and you hear someone talk about how great the book is and that you should really buy a copy and read it for yourself. And kind of, I don't know about you, but I find those things a little bit boring. I didn't want to do that because I figure the book's up the back. If you really want to work through it, you can. And that way you can purchase it and I'll get a little bit of money out of it as well. But so what I thought I'd do is instead we'll do a public lecture on a topic that I find interesting and hopefully you find interesting. In fact, it's kind of two topics that I find interesting brought together. One is we're looking at the archaeology of Israel, but I'm also fascinated by the religion of Israel as well. What do the people actually believe? How did they practice their faith? And so I thought, well, let's bring those two things together. We'll look at what can the material remains that are dug out of the earth tell us about the religious beliefs and practices of the people who are living in ancient Israel. Now, just to clarify, I advertised it as a public lecture, so I'm not too sure kind of what levels of knowledge that people are bringing to this evening's lecture. So I hope it's not too simple for some and I hope it's not too advanced for others. So, but when I talk about ancient Israel, what I'm basically got in mind there is what archaeologists refer to as Israel during the Iron II period, the Iron Age II. And that runs roughly from about 1000 BC through to 586 BC. And in terms of the biblical narrative, that means that we're looking at roughly the time of Solomon through to the fall of the southern kingdom of Judah to, my students, which empire? The Babylonians, of course, in 586 BC. So that's kind of the time that we're looking at, 1000 to 586, time of Solomon through to roughly the exile of Judah. Quite a large topic, okay? So we better get stuck into things. The first kind of remain that I want to look at this evening is personal names. That may seem a strange place to start because names don't usually mean a whole lot today. Now, names may be chosen because of their religious meaning, but this is rare, and it's certainly rare in terms of the broader world outside the church. Now, names today are generally chosen for one of two reasons. It may be chosen because, first of all, for fashion is a common reason. In 2010, there was a survey of the top boys' names and the top girls' names in the US. Top boys' names was Jacob. Top girls' name was Isabella. Why? It's Twilight. Okay, two of the lead characters out of there. Bella and Jacob. Who's the other guy? Edward. Didn't check where he came, but anyway, fashion, fads, trends determine often the choice of people's names. Another reason we choose our names is based on personal familial significance. So our only son is called James because of James Bond. No, that would be confusing it with the first one. It's called James because James is a family name on both my side and my wife's side as well. In the biblical world, though, names and the act of naming had significant religious overtones. Old Testament records numerous occasions of children being given their names. It appears roughly about 46 times. And what we often find is that there is an explicit reason that is given for the name, and there's usually a religious reason for it. So, for example, in Genesis 29, Leah names one of her sons Simeon, which means God has heard, because she believes that the Lord has heard her plight and has responded to her cries. So naming was an important and it was a meaningful act which was taken very seriously. Interestingly, it was also a task that seems to have been primarily been performed by mothers. I talked about 46 times that the act of naming is recorded in the Old Testament. On 25 occasions, it's the mother who is responsible. The father is responsible in 16 occasions. And that leaves us with, I think, five or so. And in those instances, either both are responsible or it's actually unclear who was responsible for naming the child. But naming is a significant act. And names are chosen because of their religious meaning. Now, Israelite names, like names throughout the ancient Near East, commonly consist of two elements. We have the name of a deity, which is often referred to as the theophoric element. That'll just pop up. But the theophoric element means the name of the deity. And then we have a verb or a predicate, which describes the deity's nature or activity. So I'll give you two examples. Two of the prophets, Ezekiel, his name is composed of two elements. The second half is El, which is the head of the Canaanite pantheon. It's a significant god in the ancient world, and also a god who is equated with Yahweh. In fact, El is another name for Yahweh in a number of the biblical texts. So we have El as the second part of his name, which is linked with a form of the verb meaning to strengthen. So that means El strengthens, Ezekiel. Isaiah, another one of the major prophets, a second half of his name is an abbreviated form of the name Yahweh. So YAH, which in English comes across as IAH. So Isaiah, the second half, is a form of the verb, form of the noun Yahweh. And that's linked in the first part with a form of the verb, form of the word meaning salvation. So Isaiah means Yahweh is salvation. So names function as mini confessions of faith. They give us some insight into who the Israelites worshipped and also what they believed about their gods. Now, archaeological excavations have unearthed numerous different types of remains which contain Hebrew names. And I've got some of the key examples up there. On the top right-hand side, we've got a seal, which is of Shema, a servant of Jeroboam. Jeroboam we're probably familiar with in terms of being a king of the north. So that's an example there. Names are also found on jar handles or on large storage jars. Large storage jars, there's another name for them, is pithoi. We'll refer to them kind of throughout the lecture. So they appear on storage jars, and they also appear on what is called a bulla, or in the plural, a bullae, which is basically the clay impression of a seal. Okay, and those bullae get preserved. A lot of the time they're only clay, but we've actually found them because they've been in houses that have been burnt, and as the house has been burnt, it's kind of fired the clay, and therefore it's been preserved until today. So that's a bullae of Berechiahu, son of Nehriahu, the scribe. So we've got a whole lot of different kinds of remains that show us the names of the ancient Israelites. And there was a recent survey done by a German scholar, a guy called Rainer Alberts, and he identified 675 different Hebrew names from the archaeological remains. So, what light do these names shed on the religion of ancient Israel? Remember I said names are made up of two elements. Let's consider, first of all, the divine element or the theophoric element. What do we learn from the divine elements? Well, all up, there are 25 different theophoric elements which appear in the various Hebrew names. And we can divide these into six main groups. The first group is divinized designations of kinship, which sounds really fancy, But basically what that means is that in a person's name, they won't actually give the proper name of the God, but they'll instead substitute something like father or something like brother, a kinship term in its place. And the reason they were putting kinship terms in is because it symbolises the close, the personal, the familial relationship that the believers have with God. So that's Devonized designations of kinship. Ale is often appears, I talked about it being present in Ezekiel. Ale is ambiguous because it can actually be used in two different ways. Okay, one level, ale can refer to the head of the Canaanite pantheon, a really important god in the ancient Near East. And in that sense, it's a proper name, and we might want to capitalise it as ale. But ale can also just be a generic name. It can be a common name that can just refer to God in general. And so it can actually be used as a title for Yahweh as well. Yahweh is ale. We find that appearing up a lot in Isaiah in particular. We have Yahweh as the third element. Then we have various West Semitic deities and epithets, including Baal, who you may be familiar with from the Old Testament. Egyptian gods, including Horus, Isis and Bes. And Bes will be important. I'll talk about him a little bit more later on. And then there's various adjectives which describe divine characteristics. Now, a quick skim through those figures, something will immediately strike you. What's the key thing? Yahweh. Okay, we see a vast preponderance, vast emphasis on Yahweh as being the God of the people. And so we are really struck by the Yahweh-centric nature of Israelite religion. And that shows us that Yahweh is not only being worshipped at a national level in terms of being the God of the people as a whole, but he's also the God of families as well. And he's a really important God, not just on a kind of an international scale, but also in terms of their own personal religious beliefs and practices. The Yahweh-centric nature of Israelite religion is really obvious when we compare the results from Israel with the results from Phoenicia. Phoenicia, for those of you who don't know, is located to the north of Israel. I always tell my students the way that I remember Phoenicia is because the Phoenicians actually pop up in asterisk comments if you ever spent some time reading them. And Phoenicians are the great traders that go throughout the Mediterranean. And we all actually owe the Phoenicians a very great debt because they either invented or transmitted the antecedent for our alphabet today. And because they're traders, they spread their ideas. One thing they spread was their alphabet throughout the settled world, I guess, well, the Mediterranean basin, at least. So this is what we get when we compare Phoenicia with Israel. So divinized designations of kinship is 5% in Phoenicia, 6% on ale. They don't have Yahweh for 24%, but instead they have weather deities, and that includes Baal in that list. 29% for other West Semitic deities, 8% for the Egyptian gods, 3% for various adjectives, and 26% for other Phoenician deities. Very different statistical spread from when we compare it with Israel. There is a greater variety of gods being worshipped, and there's far less concentration on a specific god than we find in Israel. So I think when we line those two up, we really do see that Yahweh's key God, the fundamental God, is widespread worship in ancient Israel. That doesn't shock you probably if you're familiar with the Old Testament, but it'll become important later on in the lecture. So that's the personal names, that's looking at the theophoric element. What about when we look at the verb or predicate that gets linked with the divine element in personal names? What do we learn from these? Well, the interesting thing when we look at these is actually what isn't there, okay? What we don't find references to in personal names is any of the significant events in the salvation history of Israel. So those key, those fundamental events that we find in the Old Testament are not appearing in personal names. So there is no reference to the Exodus, there is no reference to the conquest, there is no reference to the inheritance of the land within personal names. Okay. I'll give you an example. There is a key Hebrew verb that is used to describe the Exodus from Egypt. It's the verb yatsah, and in the form that appears, I think it's 78 times, it means to bring out. So Yahweh brought the people out of Egypt. Okay, 78 times in the Old Testament, doesn't appear once in personal names. Okay, what I think this suggests is not that these traditions were unknown, okay? But I think it suggests that these traditions are perhaps less important to the average Joe Blow, average Joe Israelite, perhaps, okay? They're not as significant for kind of your everyday Israelite. What is the focus instead then? If it's not on kind of those key events, what is the focus of their religious belief otherwise? In that study I talked about before, there are 675 names. They've been grouped together according to the verb or the predicate. And this is how Alberts has done it. Names of thanksgiving, 34%. Names of confession, 15%. Praise names, 5%. Equating names, where one God is kind of equated with another, 8%. Birth names, 30%. Secular names, 9%. What stands out to me when I look at that? It's the 30% that are connected with birth, okay? And they are connected in some way, either with conception or with pregnancy or with the actual birthing process, okay? What is fundamental to these people? It's actually Yahweh's work in them conceiving and then safely giving birth to children. Why? Why is that so important? Well, it actually makes sense as soon as you start thinking about it. Children are fundamental in an ancient agrarian society like Israel. Why are children so important? What are they? A workforce. That's right. Okay, they're little workers. I'm just waiting for James to get that little bit older. Actually, I'm so short of time, but we did some work under the house on the weekend, and James is four now, and he's just starting to chip in around the place, and I can just see a couple of years' time, I'll be able to line up the work for him. But they're a really important source of labour in an ancient agrarian society, okay? In a subsistence economy where you're reliant on the produce of the land, you need children to be doing the work. Okay. So they're important for a workforce. Why is the other reason that they're important? Yeah?
Because without them the tribes would not continue. They'd just die out.
They'd die out. Okay. Yep. So the tribes would die out. Fantastic. And kind of related to this in some way is that there isn't an ancient social welfare system, is there? Okay. So there is no Centrelink payments, there is no old age pension for you to retire on. What happens when you're no longer able to go out and work the fields like you once had? You can go hungry pretty quickly. So children are valuable because they help to provide for people in their parents in their old age. So this act of childbirth seems to be central to the religious beliefs of the ancient Israelites. Why also do we find so many names popping up in relation to childbirth? Well, we've also got to keep in mind kind of the really primitive medical and hygienic conditions that are present in ancient Israel. Okay, one study has suggested that up to 10% of women died in the act of childbirth. Okay, you're in that kind of context, it's logical. You're going to be appealing to God for help as much as you can when you're pregnant, and you're going to be thanking God when you have a child that is healthy and when the mother is healthy as well. So it's this act of childbirth which really seems to be central to the religious belief and the faith of the everyday people. There's also a couple of other different types of archaeological remains that actually shed light on this whole process of childbirth and pregnancy. Up on the left-hand side there, we have got a female pillar figurine. I'll talk about those a little bit later on. But these we find throughout Judah, Okay. I'll talk about the significance of those a little bit later on, but people often associate those with pregnancy and childbirth. We also have unearthed small statues and amulets of the Egyptian god Bes. And the reason why we find Bes, we also find Bes and we also find symbols of the Eye of Horus as well. And the reason that those two things are popping up, they've both got an Egyptian background, but both Bes and the Eye of Horus are believed to be, and I'll give you the fancy scholarly word, they're believed to be apotropaic. No, hopefully I got that out right. Apotropaic basically means evil averting. Okay, and they were believed to be particularly important in terms of protecting mothers from kind of the demonic forces that they could be subject to when they were pregnant or giving birth. We also find numerous lamps in the archaeological remains, and they served probably a purely functional purpose in terms of giving light. But we also know from comparative textual and iconographic remains that lamps are important because they keep away the forces that are associated with darkness and that are potentially hazardous to mothers who are either in the process of childbearing or who are feeding young children. So they're just some of the other remains associated with pregnancy and childbirth. Now, for those of you who have been in my lecture, this is where I'd normally stop and ask, is there any questions? But I think we'll keep on moving and jot down questions and we'll answer them at the end if you'd like. Okay, so the first kind of thing I wanted to look at was personal names, and they point to the importance of childbirth as being a key event for the majority of the people. The second type of remains I want to look at are places of worship that have been excavated by archaeologists. Now, when I talk about places of worship in ancient Israel, what are you immediately going to think of? Jerusalem Temple, okay, that was built by Solomon. Jerusalem Temple was important, it was significant, but it probably wasn't the primary place of worship for the majority of people. Okay, they would have gone there for significant occasions, perhaps on pilgrimage feasts, but the majority of their religious practice wouldn't have actually taken place there. The majority of their religious practice probably actually took place within a domestic context, and there may have been a space within the house that was set aside, or they may just have... Oh, actually, I'll show you how they may have practiced their faith in a domestic context later on. But there's different kind of levels or different types of places of worship. There's a domestic context, there is a neighbourhood shrine where kind of people from an extended family or multiple families may have come together to worship. There is a gate shrine that we find at the entrance to villages and towns, and people probably visited that either as they arrived or departed in order to seek the blessing of the god of the city. Gate shrine, there is a village or city shrine, which was the central place of worship for the village or the city. There is a regional sanctuary where people from various villages or communities would have come together to worship. And then there is the supra-regional sanctuary, which is something like the Jerusalem Temple, where people from multiple regions are coming together to worship. Now, I've got young children, so I have to be out of here by 8:30, so I'm not going to work through each of those. But what I am going to do is I'm going to choose a domestic one and a regional sanctuary, and I'll give you what I think is a representative example from each. And so this will kind of give you a feeling for these different kind of places of worship. Let's start with the regional sanctuary at Arad. Did you guys on the Israel trip make it to Arad or not? No, it's probably a bit too south for you. Okay. Arad is located on a prominent mound in the northeast section of the Beersheba Valley. It's about 40 kilometres east of Beersheba and 40 kilometres south of Hebron. Excavations revealed an Israelite fortress which had been kind of continuously occupied throughout this Iron II period. And there's another picture of the fortress up there. Now, in the northwest corner archaeologists excavated a three-room structure, which is commonly referred to as a temple. It's actually quite large. To give you some idea, that's about 10% of the floor plan of the fortress. So it's a really significant structure within the context of the fortress as a whole. Now, there is a whole lot of debate about the finds and the dating of some of the material because of faulty excavation methods and because there hasn't really been proper published final excavation reports. But recently there's kind of been the consensus coming together that this was an important place of worship during the 8th century in particular. So in terms of the biblical narrative, this would place it roughly in the time of some of the early prophets, so people like Amos, Hosea, Micah, and also kind of roughly around the time of the fall of the Northern Kingdom. The temple was aligned on an east-west axis and consists of three main rooms or three main compartments. There is a large outer courtyard, and I've got the schematic on the right and an actual photo of it on the left. So there's a large outer courtyard. There is a broad room. And then there is also a third room, although it's not really a room. It's more of a niche that you could kind of progress toward. This was elevated. You had to enter it via a couple of steps, as you can see there. And on the basis of parallels with the Jerusalem temple, scholars often refer to this as kind of the Holy of Holies, because that's kind of the small room that probably very few people would have actually had access into. Now, the dominant feature of the sanctuary is the large altar. And if I take you back a picture, you can see it both there and there, and its larger picture is there. This was located in the outer courtyard, and like the biblical instructions, it was constructed of unworked field stones with a clay and mud core. It was topped with a flint slab, which you can see there, which had channels on it, and they would have been ideal kind of for removing blood. So given its size, given its construction, most archaeologists think that this was actually used for animal sacrifice. Against that, though, very few burnt remains have actually been found on it, so we can't say for sure it was used in this way, but that seems to be its likely function, that it was a place of animal sacrifice. So at this stage, animal sacrifice is not just taking place in Jerusalem, it's also in a temple like we find at Arad. So we have the altar. As we move into the temple, we go through into the broad room. And the key distinguishing features of the broad room were the presence of these two limestone incense altars. And they kind of flanked the entrance as you worked towards the Holy of Holies. Inside the Holy of Holies, archaeologists excavated three stones that had been worked by human hands. Okay, so somehow they had been shaped or fashioned. We have one limestone that was well finished, that was rounded, and this was just under a metre high. This was probably located on the raised platform. There was also two cruder pieces of flint, and we can see them there and there. They weren't actually found in situ, they weren't found in place, but they had been lent against the walls and covered with plaster. So what are these things? What are these stones that are being located in the Holy of Holies? Scholars usually refer to them by their Hebrew name as Matzeboth. Okay, Matzeboth is a term that we find in the Hebrew Old Testament. It's translated in various ways. Sometimes it's sacred stone, sometimes it's stone pillar, sometimes it's translated as standing stone. But the interesting question to ask is, you know, what are they doing here? Why are they setting up these stones in the Holy of Holies? What's their significance? There's two main possibilities, I think. One way to understand them is that they could be a symbol of divine presence. Okay? The basis for understanding them in that way is what happens in Genesis 28, where Jacob sets up a pillar at Bethel. And Genesis 28 is that famous story where there is a ladder and there's angels descending and ascending, and Jacob has his vision of God. What does he do? He sets up a pillar in response to that, because he recognises that Bethel is a sacred location. It is a point of contact between the mundane world and the divine world, and therefore the stone becomes a symbol of that, that this is a place where God is uniquely present. So perhaps that's one way of understanding them. They are symbols of divine presence. The other way to understand them is that they're actually symbols of God, symbols of deity, perhaps deities. You're probably going to be saying, aren't Israelites forbidden from having graven images or whatever? Well, yes and no, okay? It's actually interesting to read through the second commandment. It's not, you shall not make for yourself an idol. That's the first part. But it's, you shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven, above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. Now, technically speaking, those stones don't contravene the commandment, because they are not representations of what's above in the heavens, what's on the earth, or what's below either. These are essentially aniconic, and what that means is that they are without image. They are imageless representations, perhaps, of the God. That second interpretation, that what we're actually dealing with here are things that somehow represent God, is supported by the presence of these two limestone incense altars. Got a picture here from Assyria, and I apologise. I tried to get a better quality one, okay, but there's not any around. What you will find is that incense altars are set up in mediating positions between the priest and the image of the god. Okay, so here on the right hand side we have a picture of the Assyrian king and the priest. Here in the middle we have an incense altar, and here over here we have a small kind of temple model which has got an image of the king and also an image of the god. But this altar, the incense altar, is found in that mediating position between the priests and the image of God. If we apply that kind of thinking to what we see in Arad with the incense altar there, you could well, I think, make a good case for arguing that these are not simply symbols of divine presence, but in some way actually to the ancient Israelites provided a physical representation of God in a way that wasn't contravening the second command. Of course, the only problem with that interpretation is then what do you do with the three stones that they unearthed? I'll give you a hint. It's not an early reference to the Trinity. Okay, I think we can rub that one out, but what they actually are, well, maybe that's for someone here to write a doctoral dissertation on why there is three. Okay, so that's the sanctuary at Arad, a large regional sanctuary. The second kind of place of worship I want to look at is a domestic context, and in particular at a place called Tel Halif. Tel Halif is located on the northern edge of the Negev. It's between Beersheba and the important regional centre of Lachish. Here, archaeologists excavated a row of domestic houses, and I had to put this picture in for my wife because that actually shows you what that there is. And my wife loves when they actually give you the representation of, okay, there's stones in the ground. What did it actually look like in real life? So there's the series of houses that are found on the hill at Tel Halif. These appear to have been destroyed by the Assyrian invasion that was led by Sennacherib in 701 BC. Now, the houses were fairly typical Israelite in the sense that they are all examples of four-room houses. And you don't need me to describe the significant feature of their construction, okay? We have three long rooms, which have a broad room at the rear. The house that we're interested in, actually the broad room had been divided through the insertion of a brick and stone wall. Within this larger broad room, archaeologists discovered a whole heap of remains, including religious remains. And this is actually what it probably would have looked like. Can you see there's kind of the door there? That's the door there. Okay. So this is what I'm interested in particular, the remains that they found grouped together here. The religious remains were of three kinds. We have a ceramic incense stand at the back. We also have these two stones. Again, they're worked, but we're not too sure what they were used for. Initially, people thought they were matzeboth, but that has kind of that's not so popular anymore. Most people think of them as being mini altars on which they could present small, kind of tiny offerings of food or drink. We also have the remains, the head at least, of a female figurine. Okay, and to give you some idea of what they look like, there's actually some more examples. These aren't being found in the boondocks. Okay, these aren't being found in the middle of nowhere. Those four figures there are from Jerusalem itself. Okay, and they're in one cave alone. There was more than 100 of these figurines actually found. So we can see those remains here. There is the incense altar. There is the figurines and there is the two stones as well. Alongside those religious remains, there is a whole lot of other stuff which was just used for kind of domestic purposes. There was pithoi, which are storage jars. There is cooking bowls. There is jugs. There is juglets. There is small pitchers, small bowls. There is large bowls as well. What it suggests is that food preparation was something that took place here as well. So what light does something like this, and I'm suggesting that Tel Halif is actually representative of domestic religion in general, what light does this shed on the nature of Israelite religion? Three things to me stand out. The first is that religious activity was something that took place on a regular, probably a daily basis, and it consisted of not large-scale animal sacrifice, that is very exceptional. What probably took place were simple, relatively informal tasks. For most people, this may have involved things like the presentation of offerings or gifts, and that may well have been what these small altars were used for, small offerings or gifts of food or drink. May also, religious activities may have consisted of the consumption of food. Feasting probably would have been a religious activity. There was the burning of aromatic compounds, such as incense, and probably also prayers, although it's a little bit hard to figure out prayers on the basis of archaeological remains because they don't tend to leave a lot of traces in the ground. So religious activity is probably something that is taking place on a regular daily basis. That's one thing that those remains suggest. The second thing that those remains suggest is that women, especially mothers, probably played a central role in the performance of the everyday rituals. Mothers probably lay at the heart of the practice of Israelite religion at a domestic level. The reason that they suggest this is because those remains are often found in the context of goods that are being used for food production. Ethnographic studies have shown that who does food production? The women, okay. So the fact that we are getting religious remains linked in with goods that are, or remains that are being used for food production suggests that these are probably primarily connected with women. And that's interesting because we think of Israelite religion as being very patriarchal in nature, don't we? And it probably was on a public level. Okay, men had special access. Only men could be priests. Women basically related to the cult through a male. But at the level of domestic religion, at the level of the household, probably the primary religious specialist, the religious expert, is probably the mother in the context of the family. So that's the second thing we learn, that there is that mothers probably play a key role in the practice of Israelite religion at a domestic level. What about the pillar figurines, the female figurines? What are we to make of those? As I said before, this is not anomalous. Okay, we find these throughout Judah. We find hundreds of these throughout Judah and Israel. Who or what are these figurines? It's not something that I have time to pursue in this lecture in too much detail, so hint by the book. But I'll give you the two basic interpretations for them. There is one suggestion that they are the picture of a human woman in prayer. Okay? You can probably guess what she is praying for or what they're concerned with. They're concerned with lactation. They are concerned with childbirth. Okay. So that's one suggestion, that they're human women in prayer. And one scholar, I think, quite poetically referred to them as prayers in clay. Okay, this is what the people are praying for. Healthy children, abundant children, large families. The other suggestion is that they represent a goddess who the people were actually praying to for fertility. And in that case, perhaps we would refer to them as idols. Now, significant arguments can be brought on both sides, and again, it's something that I address a little bit more detail in my book. So significant arguments. So I can't say that the scholarly preference is for one and the other, or the other, okay? You can actually kind of split it almost 50-50. But there is one find that perhaps shifts our understanding in favour of the second option, and that is that we're dealing with a representation of a goddess. Okay. So what I want to do is finish up by looking at the most significant archaeological discovery in probably the last 35 to 40 years from Israel. This is at a place called Kuntilat Ashrud. Kuntilat Ashrud is located in the deep south. Okay, it's actually located basically in the Sinai Desert. It's 60 kilometres south of Kadesh Barnea, and that's at the intersection of what was some important ancient trade routes. You can see there, though, that it's a pretty remote place, okay? Remote, isolated from any other settlement. Excavations revealed a complex which consisted of two buildings that had been used for a relatively short period of time. Archaeologists refer to this as a single-use site because it only comes into use, in this case, for about 100 years, roughly from the middle of the, let me get this straight, middle of the 9th century through to the middle of the 8th century BC. So in terms of the biblical narrative, this would put it during the period of the divided kingdom, roughly around the time of Elisha. Okay. The main building here consisted largely of a central courtyard that was flanked by a number of storerooms. Entrance was gained through the east via a vestibule that led into a gate room, or it's often referred to as a bench room because you can see kind of benches along the sides of the walls there. Of particular interest for this study was what they discovered in those bench rooms. What they found were the broken remains of two large storage jars, and I've got an image of one there reconstructed. What you can't see there, but what I've tried to show blown up here, is the fact that on these storage jars there is actually pictures displayed. This one here is this one here. We have got a sacred tree which is flanked by two ibexes. That's one image. We also have here a procession of people who appear to be in the act of prayer or the act of worship. And I like to think, therefore, that the Pentecostals have got it right. Because they're prayer or worship with raised hands, of course. Okay, so that's some images. This is the third image. All from the same, the two storage jars. This here is two depictions of the same God. We've already come across that God before. It is the god Bes. And we've got Egyptian representations of that god there. Why is Bes popping up here at Kuntilla Ashrud? Because he helps ladies in childbirth? No, that's not it. But he's also believed to protect travellers during, especially when they go through the dangers of the wilderness. Okay, wilderness is a harsh, hostile place, and therefore there is images of Bes, a demigod. And it's interesting that those pithoi with images of Bes are actually found in this room. Why do we think they may be found there? They're guarding the entrance. Okay, so they're guarding the entrance in through to the fortress. You've got your images of Bes who are supposed to protect the people inside. So we've got two images of Bes here. We've also got here a picture of a female lyre player. And we're not really too sure about the identity of that female. It could just be a woman, a worshipper. It may be a queen because that's a throne. It could be an image of a goddess. Unfortunately, these things don't come labelled, this is X, okay? So we can really only kind of speculate about who or what that might be. The other interesting thing about the pithoi, the storage jars, is that they actually have inscriptions written on them. I've got two of the inscriptions there. Thus says X, say to Yahala'el, Yoasar, and someone else. I bless you too before, or another translation is by, Yahweh of Samaria and his Asherah. Thus says Amariah, say to my Lord, is it well with you? I bless you too before or by Yahweh of Taman and his Asherah. May he bless you and keep you and be with you, my Lord. Provoked a whole series of scholarly articles trying to come to grips with who or what is this Asherah that is connected with Yahweh. Two main suggestions have been put forward. We know from other ancient Near Eastern documents that Asherah is actually the name of a goddess. Okay, and in that case, when we're doing our translation work, we might like to put Asherah in capital letters. Asherah is a significant goddess. She is married to Ael in the Canaanite pantheon, who is the head of the gods. And there is therefore the provocative suggestion here that did some of the ancient Israelites actually think that Yahweh had a consort? Okay, that it was Yahweh and his Asherah. And one archaeologist has written a book, probably. Good idea to come up with provocative titles when you're writing a book, but his title was Did God Have a Wife? And, well, maybe some of the Israelites may have thought so. There is a problem, though, with that interpretation, and the problem with that interpretation is that it doesn't really fit the grammar. We've got his. In both cases, it's his Asherah. Now, his in Hebrew is represented by a suffix, and that kind of suffix does not normally get put on proper names. Okay? So we wouldn't normally expect his to be linked with a proper name, capital Asherah. Okay? It doesn't seem to fit the grammar. At least there is no precedent for it. So the other option is that it's a common noun. We actually find references to Asherim in the Old Testament, and there it appears to refer to a wooden cult object because Asherim can be built, They can be cut down, they can be burned. Okay, so there seems to be some sort of wooden cult object in mind. Strong arguments can be made for either side. At the end of the day, perhaps the thing we've got to be careful, though, is of driving kind of a hard and a fast wedge between the two different options. Even if we go for the fact that it is a wooden cult object, why is that wooden cult object popular? Why is it believed to be a source of blessing? Well, perhaps because in some way it's actually connected with a goddess. Okay? So even if we go with that second interpretation, I don't think it automatically rules out the possibility that some Israelites were worshipping a female god, goddess, Asherah. I have to move fast because we're running short of time. There is also a number of other inscriptions found at Kuntilla Ashrud. They're difficult to put together because they were inscribed on plaster, which has since fallen off the wall. And to kind of give you an idea, it's therefore like trying to put together a puzzle, but the only problem is you don't actually have an image, so you don't actually know what you're working towards. So you can kind of put it together. These are some of the inscriptions, but they're very broken. Your days may be prolonged and you shall be satisfied. Give Yahweh of Teman and his Asherah. Again, another reference to Asherah. Yahweh of Teman and his Asherah. But we also find references to other gods as well. And when Ale rose up and hills melted and peaks were pounded, bless Baal in the day of war, in the name of Ale, in the day of war. But we find references to these other gods, Ale, Baal, alongside Yahweh as well. So what are we to make of the finds from Kuntilla Ashrud? I started out the night looking at personal names. These suggested that Israel was essentially a monotheistic nation, with the vast majority of names indicating that people venerated Yahweh. But if you're a careful reader of the Old Testament, that would actually leave you with all sorts of questions, not least of which is why did people like Jeremiah and Hosea spend so much time banging on about the people worshipping other gods if they weren't, in fact, worshipping other gods, which is what personal names perhaps suggest. So the finds from Kuntilla Ashrud in fact provide an important balancing witness to the personal names. They show us that polytheism was present in ancient Israel and that multiple gods and goddesses were believed to be powerful and a source of blessing, that this was a genuine problem that the people struggled with. These finds thus provide important contextual information for understanding the rebuke of Israel's prophets, the warnings of the law, and the cautions from Israel's history as well. So, thank you for coming. I've got some time for questions. If you'd like, we can do that. And then we can break. And I think there is some tea and coffee at the back. And if you want to buy a copy of the book, you can get that on the left-hand side. That's if you want to know more. Okay. Thank you.